I'm Anthony Brooks in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Coming up, how the war in Iraq is dominating the presidential race. But first, another sign of eroding confidence in the government of Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki. The National Intelligence Estimate on Iraq is being released today. This represents the combined wisdom of the country's 16 spy agencies. According to the New York Times, the report expresses grave doubts about the ability of the Iraqi government to heal the sectarian divide. And it suggests that the continued weakness of the Baghdad government could undermine whatever military gains have been made. Joining us with more on this is Mark Mazzetti, national security correspondent for the New York Times. And welcome, Mark.
Thanks for having me.
Mark, tell us what you've learned about what this report says in terms of confidence in the Maliki government.
Well, according to several people who have read the report, they said that the report not only talks about the lack of political progress over the year in bridging the sectarian divides in Iraq, but it kind of gives a prognosis that's fairly dim about the prospects of overcoming these hurdles. In other words, can the Maliki government get Sunni, Shia, and Kurds together to bridge a sort of political unity in Iraq? And the report is going to say that the prospects aren't good.
So how damaging will this be to the Maliki government, to the prime minister himself?
Well, ultimately, the amount of confidence that the Bush administration has in him and his government is important. Maliki pushed back earlier this week saying that, you know, only Iraqis matter. It doesn't matter what outsiders think of him. However, if the U.S. loses confidence in Maliki's government and really starts looking for alternatives, then that's going to put Iraq into even greater political chaos. It should be noted that I believe the report is going to say that there aren't great alternatives to Maliki. It's going to say that as difficult as Maliki has found it to bridge any kind of political unity, finding another person might be even more difficult.
Mm.
So it's a kind of damned if you do, damned if you don't scenario.
Yeah, and this is significant because political progress in Iraq has been one of the sort of linchpins, in a way, of what the Bush administration has been arguing for in terms of the kind of progress that it wants to see in Iraq. So this is quite significant, isn't it?
Absolutely. The whole stated point of this troop surge in Iraq is what the White House has called a mission to give, quote, breathing space to Iraqi politicians. In other words, reduce violence in order to allow Iraqi politicians to work out a compromise. And the report is going to say that there have been some gains on the security front. But ultimately, everyone agrees that the politics is what matters. If they can't make a compromise, then it's ultimately not going to matter what U.S. troops do. And as the new chairman, the incoming chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff said, if there isn't political compromise, he said, quote, no amount of troops and no amount of time will make much of a difference.
Mm.
So it does matter what kind of compromise can and will happen.
Interesting week because President Bush, at one point on Tuesday, he seemed to be distancing himself from Maliki. Then yesterday, he offered sort of lukewarm praise for the prime minister, calling him a good guy with a difficult job. How do those comments tie in with what we're seeing in the National Intelligence Estimate, in your view?
Well, we do know that the president was briefed on Monday on the estimate, so he had knowledge of what the intelligence community had found when he made those comments the next day about Maliki. The White House insists that it retained support for Maliki, that he has not lost the confidence of President Bush, but certainly President Bush's own intelligence agencies are saying that the Maliki government is a weak government and may not be able to overcome these deep sectarian divisions that have plagued Iraq for years.
We've been reading some press reports about the intelligence estimate, and one of the points that I found interesting is that extremists could launch mini Tets, referring to the Tet Offensive during the Vietnam War back in 1968. Interesting language to use the day after we hear President Bush drawing a link between the war in Iraq and Vietnam, don't you think?
Yeah, there's a lot of Vietnam reference is flying around. The president directly referenced Vietnam yesterday. The report, we believe, does make a reference to a possible Tet-like offensive before the September report that's due from Ambassador Crocker and General Petraeus, which is really the progress report on the surge. And the intelligence assessment, we believe, is going to say that in advance of that report, insurgents might try to launch a string of attacks to ratchet up the violence level.
Well, Mark Mazzetti, thanks so much for following this story and for joining us today.
Okay,
I appreciate
thanks
it.
Thanks a lot.
That's Mark Mazzetti, national security correspondent for the New York Times, talking to us about the new National Intelligence Estimate on Iraq. We're going to spend the next few minutes talking about how that latest grim assessment on Iraq and the politics of the war are playing out on the presidential campaign trail. Speaking yesterday to a group of veterans, President Bush warned against what he called the allure of retreat and said that a free Iraq is within reach. Senators Hillary Clinton, Barack Obama, and John McCain, all presidential hopefuls, have all addressed the same veterans group this week with a more measured take on success in Iraq, though Hillary Clinton said that parts of the surge strategy are working, while Barack Obama called the war a complete failure. Meanwhile, groups for and against the war are set to flood the airwaves with ads tailored to affect the electorate and put pressure on political leaders. Well, with us to talk about this moment in American politics and to help us venture out a bit onto the campaign trail is Bill Curry. He's a columnist for the Hartford Current and joins us from Hartford, Connecticut. Bill, welcome. Great to have you on the show.
Great to be here, Anthony. Thank you.
Also with us is Kimberly Strassel. She writes the Potomac Watch column for the Wall Street Journal and joins us from Washington. Welcome, Kimberly.
Hello.
Hey, thanks for joining us. Well, let me start with you, Bill. Vietnam continues to be the great dividing line in American politics, it seems. The president specifically brought it up this week, as we mentioned, saying in effect that withdrawal from Vietnam was bad for the U.S. and a political and human rights disaster for Indochina. That's the lesson the war in Iraq should tell us. Why go back to Vietnam? Does the comparison work?
Well, first of all, I think it's ironic that the president at this late hour finally sees an analogy to Vietnam that he's comfortable with. From the very beginning of the discussion, that, you know, this was it was an absolute uniform talking point for the administration that Iraq wasn't like Vietnam just because it was another country whose language we didn't speak, whose culture we didn't understand, the ferocity of whose resistance we would underestimate, and whose methods we could not comprehend, that we were to ignore all those analogies. But now there's an analogy, and that is that if, in fact, we lose, it'll be the fault of the people who criticized the effort all along. Hmm. Everybody who had the spine to stand up when it was difficult and say that this was a mistake, and all the millions more who have joined them. The great Vietnam analogy that is left to us is whether there will be an effort on the part of the commander-in-chief and his political allies to blame their own colossal failures on the people who had better sense.
Kimberly Strassel, what's your take on this Vietnam analogy that the president brought out this week?
I think that it's very clearly attempting to play on simply an emotional feeling that a lot of Americans have, and in that regard it might actually be very effective, which is that Americans don't like to lose. And that, I think, was what the president was attempting to draw out yesterday, which was to say, you know, do we want this to be another example of America cutting and running, which is, you know, words that have been used by Republicans all along in this. And I think that might actually be something that does resonate with people. Look, you know, one thing that I think that is interesting about this debate is that, you know, you have a lot of Democrats out there saying this war is a failure and a number of Americans want to come home, and some of the polls suggest that slightly, but what you do actually see more is that Americans simply want this to work, and that was something that I think was much more clear in the election last year than any sense that they wanted immediate withdrawal, which is Americans wanted to be able to say we did this and we did it right and to have some sort of success in Iraq. Not necessarily they wanted to leave immediately. Mm.
Well, there have been some signs of success or progress in the wake of this surge or as a result of this surge. Do you think this could give a boost? Let's start first with Republican candidates who are trying to run for president, who've maintained a stay the course line. What do you think, Kimberly?
It's certainly going to give them a little bit of cover. Look, I think you saw earlier in the summer a lot of Republican senators in particular who'd come under fire. There were a lot of ads that were being run against them. They'd been targeted by some Democratic groups that wanted them to feel the pressure to change their position and advocate withdrawal. What this does, that's put them in a difficult position because for every one of those people in their state that want them out immediately, there are Republicans in the base who want them to see this through. So they've been in a sort of sticky middle. This may actually give them a little bit of cover to sort of say, hey, at least for now, the surge appears to be making some sort of progress. We should give it a little bit more time. Mm.
And Bill, what do you think for the Democrats? To the extent that there have been signs of some progress in Iraq, does this make it difficult for them, or are they shifting on Iraq? What are you seeing?
Well, throughout Bush's second term, his most formidable adversaries have not been the Democrats, but arithmetic and reality across a broad range of issues, and reality most of all in Iraq. it's amazing. These intelligence estimates seem to be leaked out now every few weeks, each of which could be summarized simply by saying everything you read in the newspapers and hear on the radio is true. and also, by the way, consistent with the broad position of the Democratic Party as opposed to the Republican Party. And so Bush's great fear here, the Republicans who are following him, is simply that the facts are catching up with him. It's hard to square that report you were talking about earlier with Kimberly's analysis just now. And I don't mean that it refutes it entirely, but if you take a look at it, they're in tougher shape than that. I also just point out
– Yeah, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Go ahead, Kimberly.
Yeah, go ahead, Kimberly.
No, I don't want to interrupt. Let Bill finish.
I just look at the two sad stories of McCain and Giuliani. I think ultimately Giuliani starts going well now, but
what are you referring to specifically? The two sad stories.
That's because there's a sort of bifurcated legacy on national security of George Bush. One is Iraq, and the other is terrorism. The really sad story right now is McCain's, because he inherited the Iraq mantle. The happy story for now is Giuliani's, because he inherited the terrorism mantle. Which goes along, you know, which comes across much better right now, but I think is also because of the facts as they develop, not a great long-term strategy.
Hmm. I just don't know if I buy that entirely, though, because I mean, let's look at what's happened just in the last week, which is actually quite remarkable in terms of the political climate, in which you have seen a number of Democrats who themselves have now had to entirely shift the debate on Iraq. You know, their goal, their intention, was to wait for the Petraeus report to come out and then sort of say, look, nothing's working and we need to again have a vote on withdrawal. And instead, the news that is coming out is that we are making progress on the military front in Iraq. So now you've seen this big shift in the talking points among Democrats themselves. This is their own realization that, you know, it is a little bit more risky now to sort of say this isn't working. They don't want to be seen to not be supporting the good work that the troops are doing on the ground there. And so instead we're having a discussion about whether political benchmarks have been met. And you're seeing that, a wholesale kind of shift in terms of how we're going to evaluate the Petraeus report when it comes out.
Well, that's going to be an interesting point of discussion, and of course that report coming out next month. We're going to just take a break. We're going to come back to both of you and continue this conversation and also talk about, we've been focusing on presidential candidates, but this is a live issue for members of Congress as well. We want to get into a little bit of that. We're talking to Kimberly Strassel. She's a member of the editorial board at the Wall Street Journal and writes the Potomac Watch column for the paper, and to Bill Curry, columnist for the Hartford Current. And we're going to have more after a short break. And later in the show, the warrantless wiretapping surveillance program, just how many Americans are being watched. That's coming up. Stay with us here and now. I'm Anthony Brooks. It's Here and Now. We're talking about the war in Iraq and how it's playing out on the political campaign trail and across the political world. And we're talking with Kimberly Strassel. She's a member of the Wall Street Journal editorial board and writes the Potomac Watch column. And with Bill Curry, columnist for the Hartford Current. And Kimberly and Bill, we've been focused on the presidential candidates, but this is a live issue as well for members of Congress. Many Democrats came in riding a strong anti-war sentiment in the country, but they don't have a whole lot of legislative success to show for it. And I want to play an ad just to give it flavor for what's going on. Here's an ad targeting war supporters like Kentucky Senator Mitch McConnell. The ad is from Americans Against Escalation in Iraq. Let's listen.
Mitch McConnell has supported Bush's endless war in Iraq for 4 years. Now Bush's general says we have to stay there for 10 more.
The average counterinsurgency is somewhere around a 9 or a 10-year endeavor.
Where are we going to get the troops to stay that long? The draft.
I think it makes sense to certainly consider it. This has always been an option on the table.
Tell Mitch McConnell to end this war. Paid for by the Campaign to Defend America.
So that was an ad from Americans Against Escalation in Iraq. Bill Curry, what do you think? How does this issue play out for members of Congress?
Geez, you wonder where they get those announcers, though, don't you?
I'm going to send them a resume, yeah, okay? You
know, imagine having dinner with that guy. I would just picking up on something that Kimberly said earlier that I do agree with, and that is that people want something more from the Democrats than what they're getting. And they don't – I'm not so sure that victory in Iraq is what they want, but I am sure that safety is what they want, and I am sure that peace is what they want. I don't believe that a substantial majority of Americans think that George Bush is pursuing strategies that would lead that increase their safety and security. I think most people now do believe we're less safe and less secure because of our heavy footprint in the Middle East. I don't think they think these strategies are ever going to lead to peace. But they don't hear a counter strategy from the Democrats. And in the great Washington phrase factory, Democrats, even more than Republicans, have been too reliant on pollsters and spin. They don't understand that policy precedes message, that you have to put a blueprint on the table. And if anything, in my party of my life, it wins one election and cops an attitude and thinks that that sort of just strategy that it can bowl through to another victory without putting more cards on the table, more policy cards, it really has to here.
Mm. Kimberly, what do you think of this strategy? And then I want to turn the corner and get away from the war and talk about some other issues on the campaign trail.
I think what's remarkable is the last few weeks you really have seen the terrain shifting under both parties' feet. And it's sort of fascinating. You know, there's a lot of headlines this week about Brian Baird, who is a Democrat from Washington State. He went over to do a trip to Iraq and came back, and you know, he had voted against the war and voted for withdrawal. And he now says he is more inclined to actually see if this surge works. And again, I think this gets back to the fact that, we were talking about Vietnam earlier, and here's one thing that is a much different element to today's war than Vietnam, which is that the public still remains very much united behind its military in this particular event. And so that has put, I think, Democrats in an awkward position in that, you know, if the military is seen to be doing something successful in Iraq, they don't want to be seen as a political party to not be recognizing that and not be fully supporting the actions of the troops. So you do have people who are going over there, they're reading the news, and this has sort of put a kink in some of these, you know, desires to simply withdraw, get this over with, in particular before next year's presidential race. And as a result, is going to make things a little bit more complicated when this Petraeus report comes up. Republicans, too, I think they're now getting some help. You ran those ads from some groups that are still firmly behind the war. And it'll be interesting to see whether or not they feel as much pressure as they have over the summer to distance themselves.
Hmm. Well, as I said, I want to get to some other issues. And let's focus on the Republicans for a minute. Kimberly, you mentioned the Republicans. There doesn't seem to be a clear front runner right now, though it may be significant that former New York City Mayor Rudolph Giuliani is the man most under attack from the other candidates, at least this week. Former Senator Fred Thompson attacked him for being pro-gun control. And here's an ad from former Massachusetts Governor Mitt Romney attacking Giuliani for making New York into a sanctuary for illegal immigrants. Let's listen.
Immigration laws don't work. That's the problem with cities like Newark, San Francisco, and New York City that adopt sanctuary policies. Sanctuary cities become magnets that encourage illegal immigration and undermine secure borders.
What do you think, Bill? Is this a potent issue that resonates out on the campaign trail for the Republicans?
I suppose it's the danger of being mayor of New York so long nearby that Statue of Liberty that you get softened and confused. You know, give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses. Imagine trying to get that inscription on a statue today. I don't think so. I think a much greater long-term worry for Rudy Giuliani is twofold. And if anybody's read, I think it's Dan Collins and I think Wayne Baird wrote The Grand Illusion, a meticulous refutation of his reputation as an administrator and as someone who knows in the least about terrorism. And I think that in the longer term, in fact, it's his record as mayor and other aspects of his own persona that are going to be his undoing. It's not going to be gun control. Gun control is one issue in Idaho and another issue in New York. It's not going to drive the election. I don't think that anybody looks at New York and thinks that Rudy Giuliani was going to, in New York, be the one guy who, with only municipal jurisdiction, was going to solve this problem.
Yeah.
But I think his issues are a lot bigger than that.
Right. We're getting close to the end of our time, but I want Kimberly Strassel, what are the issues that you think are going to drive? I mean, and we've talked about Iraq, and obviously that's sort of impossible to avoid. But other than that, what are the sort of domestic issues that are going to drive this campaign from here on out, do you think?
Oh, well, I mean, it's a lot of it's going to be about this general question, which we keep talking about, and then it gets manifested in all these different issues about insecurity that Americans feel with the economy, with the war at the moment. So, you know, domestically, you're going to see a lot of discussions about health care. People are very worried about their costs. We're probably going to see some more. It hasn't happened as much yet, but economic discussions. Do people feel like they're getting ahead in this world? Where do tax cuts play into that?
Hmm.
So that's probably where you'll see the main focus.
Okay, well, listen, we're out of time. I want to thank you both for joining us. Kimberly Strassel writes the Potomac Watch column for the Wall Street Journal, and Bill Curry, columnist for the Hartford Current. Thank you both for joining us.
Thanks.
It was a pleasure. Thanks, Anthony.
Real pleasure. Stick around. There's more ahead here and now. Anthony Brooks in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. One of the hallmarks of the Bush administration has been its penchant for secrecy, which has sparked a series of confrontations with Congress. A case in point, of course, the controversial warrantless surveillance program, which the administration says is necessary in its war against Islamic extremism. Well, now one small piece of that veil of secrecy has been peeled away. The nation's top intelligence official, Mike McConnell, disclosed to a Texas newspaper the number of people in the U.S. who are under this kind of surveillance. He put that number at 100 or less. McConnell wants to assure critics that the program will not result in federal agents snooping into the lives of Americans everywhere. Outside of the U.S., McConnell says the number of people under surveillance is in the thousands. These revelations come amidst growing concern in Washington about precisely how much power Congress handed the administration last month when it reauthorized the warrantless surveillance program. Eric Lischblau, Washington correspondent for the New York Times, has been reporting this story, and he joins us now. Hello, Eric.
Hello, how are you?
Very well, thanks, and thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
In your piece earlier this week, you offer a startling example. You say the new law, as reauthorized, could allow federal agents to demand the business records from an American in America without a court-approved warrant. How so?
Well, what Congress did when it rewrote the FISA law just a few weeks ago was to redefine the very meaning of electronic surveillance, and it did it in such a broad way that, according to a number of national security experts that we've talked to, there could be the real possibility of unintended consequences that go beyond just wiretapping, which is what the debate in Congress was about, to a whole host of other areas, including business records, phone records, and even the prospect of physical searches. Now, this is all a matter of some heated debate, but it's a real debate. There were a number of Capitol Hill staffers who have met privately with administration officials to air their concerns about these possibilities and say, "Is this what you meant to do?" I think what the debate reflects is the fact that the legislation was passed in such a hurried way. It really flew through Congress at its recess in about 36 hours, that a lot of members were not clear what they were even voting on.
Wow. Well, I want to get to that in a minute, but go back to this particular example that we started the segment with. That is, it's my understanding that a businessman in Chicago, for example, could be required to turn over all of his business records if the investigation began with a foreign target. Is that correct?
Right. One of the most significant things about the change in the law that Congress approved this month was to change the focus to the target of the intercept or the surveillance. And if the administration can demonstrate that they're not targeting the person in the U.S., that person in the U.S. is just incidental to someone overseas, they then have the ability to gather up intelligence on that person, so long as they show that person is not the actual target.
Mm. Now, why did Congress approve this law? You say there's a suggestion that a lot of them, were rushing to get out of town. They just didn't read the fine print. Is that really a part of it?
Well, this started as what was described as a narrow fix in the intelligence law because of a problem apparently brought about by a court ruling, a secret court ruling, that left it up in the air as to whether or not a warrant was needed to get intercepts from one foreign location to another foreign location, if that happened to go through the United States. This gets very technical, I realize. So the White House and the Director of National Intelligence said that this was creating major intelligence gaps in their overseas coverage. But the fix that Congress ultimately ended up approving went far beyond just that narrow issue and really opened up a lot of other doors at the same time.
Hmm. So is there going to be an effort to amend the law when Congress returns? I mean,
are
Democrats sort of saying, whoa, we didn't mean to do that?
That's already happened. I mean, that happened literally within hours of the measure being approved. You know, the Democrats got quite a lot of heat from their own constituents for having gone along with this. There were, I believe, it was 16 members, Democrats in the Senate, who voted for this, and it, you know, was not a proud moment for the Senate Democratic leadership or the House, for that matter. And I think the White House was just seen as having played this issue more skillfully than the Democrats.
Hmm. But no one in the administration is claiming that they wanted this law so that they could just do wholesale spying and snooping on Americans across the country. I mean, that isn't the point they're making, that they needed this to clear up the idea that they do not need a court order warrant to spy on someone abroad.
That was the original point,
but
certainly almost everyone agrees that the legislation that's approved goes several significant steps beyond that. It does not just deal with this very narrow issue of a foreign-to-foreign phone call or a foreign-to-foreign email. It opens up several other possibilities, you know, that clearly at least touch on Americans' communications. And the debate is whether it is just how far it goes in potentially sweeping up those communications.
Well, we began the segment talking about Michael McConnell's, that's the Director of National Intelligence, his comments to a Texas newspaper today about the very, very limited number of Americans under surveillance. How does the significance of what he said strike you? I mean, was it significant that he sort of—
Well, I think the timing was certainly significant because that's a number that the administration has never been willing to give before, even though there have been repeated efforts from the media, from members of Congress publicly to put that out. We know from the FISA court, which oversees this, that there are now something in the order of 2,000 wiretaps a year that are approved, which is a significant increase from pre-9/11. It's about three times as many. But the administration has never broken it out in the way that McConnell is now doing, in terms of saying, well, it's apparently a tiny fraction that involve U.S. persons. That number is startlingly low, if true, but I do add the if true, because there's a lot of very technical nuances here that we may be missing. I think the intent is clear, which is to say that you know, this isn't something that most Americans need to worry about.
Interesting. The Senate Judiciary Committee has subpoenaed documents from the administration on the legal justification for the warrantless wiretapping program. The White House admits it has the documents but wants more time. What do you see coming out of this fight, finally?
Well, Senator Leahy this week threatened to initiate contempt proceedings against the White House over what he sees as their failure to comply with the subpoena. He says that they had a hard deadline of this past Monday that they failed to meet. The White House had sent several letters over. Vice President Cheney's office had also sent a letter saying that they needed more time, that they wanted to negotiate this in good faith and a cooperative way. Leahy is taking a hard-line stance, at least publicly. We'll have to see if he makes good on the threat or if this is just sort of a negotiating ploy.
Eric Lischblau, thanks so much for joining us today.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Eric Lischblau is Washington correspondent for The New York Times. Just a reminder, you can listen to today's show stream on our website, here-now.org. For past programs, click on the archives. And you can download a podcast and take us with you wherever you go. That's here-now.org. And before we go today, Bill Littlefield, and later comedian Mort Saul, 80 years old and still riffing on politics and the presidency. That's coming up here and now. And now to our national pastime. A game last night between the Texas Rangers and the Baltimore Orioles gave new meaning to the word lopsided.
The 1-0 pitch. Swung on. High drive, deep right field. Back goes Peyton. It is history. A three-run homer. Ramon Vasquez. The Rangers have scored 30 runs tonight. Absolutely unbelievable. It is 30-3.
30-3. 30-3. That's Bill Littlefield laughing in the background, who joins us every week to talk about historic drubbings and other issues from the world of sports. Bill, this was an 30 runs. We're not talking about a fraternity team with a beer cooler in the dugout.
No,
we're talking about a Major League Baseball
allegedly
team.
Allegedly, professional pitching staff was involved. Quite remarkable. And if the Red Sox could have just rented or leased two of those 30 runs, which the Rangers wouldn't have missed, they could have beaten the Devil Rays 3-2. That's how baseball works.
Unbelievable. Well, the Orioles' humiliation came the very day they announced that Dave Tremblay as their permanent manager. What a way to start a job. Tremblay was asked by how he would handle defeat. This is what he had to say.
You have a real short memory and you let it go.
what else is there to say? Fire everybody?
But I guess there's history here. I think that's the first time since 1897 that a team scored 30 runs or more.
Mm-hmm. Anyway. And there's every possibility that they'll be shut out tonight.
Yeah, that's right.
as my friend Tim Kirkchen, who knows much, much more about baseball than I do, always says, that's the glory of baseball, Bill.
That's the glory. Well, speaking of the glory of baseball, and while we're talking about baseball, let's talk about the age-old rivalry very briefly in the American League East. A few weeks ago here in Boston, Red Sox fans were positively reveling in a 14.5 game lead over their hated Yankees. And just like that, New York is back in the race, just 5 games behind Boston. Is this deja vu all over again, Bill?
Well, Boston fans should, take a reality check. They still have their team, still has the best record in baseball. And, I think there's every reason to think that they'll be just fine. And beyond that, they don't have to win the pennant, There's the wild card, and that's how Boston gets to the World Series generally anyhow. So we'll be all right.
Okay. Turning to away from baseball, to women's basketball, tonight the WNBA begins its postseason. Are last year's champions, the Detroit Shock, the favorites to repeat?
Detroit's very strong, good team, but I think the interesting thing about the WNBA is the season is so relatively short that it doesn't necessarily prove who's going to be the best team. And so you got Lauren Jackson in Seattle with the Seattle Storm coming off her best season. She could dominate in a short playoff series. You have Phoenix in the playoffs for the first time in 6 years, and 3 members of the Phoenix team are in the top 10 scoring in the league. So all 3 of them get hot. Phoenix could certainly blow past a couple of teams.
Are they getting the kind of coverage and excitement around this event?
Not as much as they would like, obviously, but if you have watched games, particularly toward the end of the season, I watched a Connecticut game, the Sun playing the other night, their last regular season game, and no matter where the camera was showing, no matter what the angle, the stands were full of people, so that's good news.
That's good news. Finally, Bill, we have to ask you about golfer Sheila Drummond. On Sunday, now, probably not everybody knows this, but on Sunday she did what all golfers dream of. She hit a hole in one, but there's an even more extraordinary story here, and tell us.
Yes, Sheila is completely blind, and she has been completely blind for 30 years from the effects of diabetes. And the most remarkable thing, I met Sheila at a tournament for blind golfers earlier this summer. The most remarkable thing about her is she didn't learn to play golf until after she had completely lost her sight. Most of the blind golfers played golf while they still could see and continued playing after they could no longer see. She really is the exception. And sure enough, she had a hole in one. And, the great thing about the story is she heard it hit the pin.
That's amazing.
So she did get the experience of the hole in one, although even she obviously couldn't see it.
Well, Bill Littlefield, thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure, Anthony.
Always a pleasure to lighten the day with a little bit of talk about historic drubbings and inspiring stories about golfers. Thanks very much. Bill Littlefield, host of the NPR show Only a Game. After a break, comedian Mort Saul. Stay tuned here and now. I'm Anthony Brooks. It's Here and Now. Comedian Mort Saul stepped onto the stage in the 1950s. It was Ike Eisenhower's America, when Lenny Bruce was still doing impressions and a generation of Borscht Belt comics were telling jokes about their mothers-in-law. But back then, Mort Saul would saunter on stage in a V-neck sweater, carrying a folded-up newspaper. He looked like a guy relaxing in a jazz club, and like a jazz player, he riffed about the state of the world, politics, the president, telling jokes without punchlines.
All right. Now, we have... Now, are there any groups which we have not offended in some small way? I've gone into every field except theism. I'll do that on the next show, and I'll tell you all about the Billy Graham rally in New York, which I went to in your interest, kind of a consumer's test.
Mort Saul took on everyone, the Beats, Joe McCarthy, the Korean War, whoever occupied the White House. He wrote jokes for President Kennedy, but his career was almost extinguished when he went too far with one monologue, linking JFK to the Mafia and Frank Sinatra. But Saul survived. There were new targets for his wit, Nixon, Watergate, Clinton, and the Bushes. He turned 80 this year, and this past June in L.A., he was honored by comedians from George Carlin to Woody Allen, who said Mort Saul was the first to make the country listen to jokes that required people to think. Mort Saul is on tour now, and he's here in the Boston area to perform at Jimmy Tingle's Off-Broadway, and he joins us now in the studio. And Mort Saul, welcome.
Thanks, Anthony.
It's great to have you here. Tell us about that celebration in Brentwood on June 28th. We hear that Albert Brooks read your eulogy, I guess a little early.
Pretty funny, actually.
Did he get it right?
They were all very good. They didn't live up to their the reputation they have of being selfish and self-centered. It was quite an open-hearted celebration. It was wonderful.
Well, let's hear some more of your work that was being honored that night. This is you in 1960 riffing on anti-Russian paranoia. Let's listen.
So we had never had a spy, and we tried to do, you know, better in the Olympics and build a better car and a lot of things like that, but we never had a spy, and people began to get depressed for several years. And it got so bad, as you recall, for a while they had a committee to find spies. That was their job, and they used to travel around and try to find spies, and they were pretty good guys, but let's face it, you know, if there's none to be had, there's none to be had. So there was a kind of a retaliatory thing going on, and for a long time, you remember that there was a kind of a Cold War, the seesaw, and every time the Russians would put an American in jail, this committee would put an American in jail, but that didn't quite meet the need. Remember this?
That's funny stuff. And you're a fast talker.
That clip you played is an example of what Bob Hope had told me. You know, he said, keep talking and nobody will notice the silence. When nobody laughs at the jokes, just keep moving. Be a moving target. That's where that style developed.
And it was a style that earned you the nickname Rebel Without a Pause at one point.
I just kept going. But, you know, I was fortunate because the audience is involved and they are smart.
It may be difficult for people to imagine today with programs like Letterman, Jay Leno, The Daily Show, doing political humor every night. But when you were doing that back in the 60s, it was really revolutionary. What inspired you back then to do that?
I just had a view of America. I thought what happened to America was crucial. And the fact of the matter is, those are not political programs. I mean, humor's all right, and it's out of the headlines. But as far as going to the meat of what these 20 candidates are about and where this country's going, you have to meditate on that for a while before you talk about it. George Bush is the son of a president. The apple doesn't rot far from the tree, or whatever you happen to say. But it comes out of point of view, and it comes out of a concern for America's soul. Political jokes are really just currency of the moment.
I want to just go back to the era that you started in. What made that era so ripe for your kind of humor, do you think?
Well, it started in San Francisco. And there was a huge audience out there who turned out to be the oppressed majority.
What do you mean by that?
Well, they thought they weren't being listened to. They thought it was the Eisenhower / McCarthy period, and everybody was a conformist. And they found out that they weren't alone. That was the big ticket. And San Francisco was the perfect crucible.
So give us a sense of the mood in San Francisco then, when you say it was the
well,
big
it was
ticket.
Open to suggestion. I mean, Kerouac was around then, and Lawrence Ferlinghetti, and a lot of gung-ho left-wing folk singers. There was music behind that anti-war movement. You notice this one, hasn't it?
Yeah, what do you make of that? Why no music?
Well, they're not drafting anybody.
Huh. Yeah, that would change things. Tell us how you ended up working, briefly, I understand, for John F. Kennedy.
Well, his father came to me and said that he thought I'd be very deft at doing some jokes about Nixon for them. And the old man tolerated no interference, but I guess everybody knows that by reputation.
Right, the old man being Joe Kennedy, of course.
Yeah. But the president was a very worthwhile man and a man of peace, and it was my great pleasure to know him. I knew a lot of guys along the way. That's one of the great things about the job. Adlai Stevenson, Eugene McCarthy, I mean, got to know some good guys. You'll notice, by the way, that nobody running now has a sense of humor. Kennedy had a sense of humor. Reagan had a sense of humor. These people, unless their candidacy is their idea of a joke, we can make that the exception.
After JFK became president, you went from writing jokes for him, but you didn't spare him from your humor.
No, you can't. It's like that great Brando Western, One-Eyed Jacks, when he says to Carl Malden, "You may have been elected sheriff, but I'm still in business. I'm an outlaw." That's almost the Bible.
So you stayed true to your profession. Some people felt, well, some, you know, the man himself, I guess, Joe Kennedy, felt you went too far in a particular monologue, right?
The old man didn't like it. The president kind of appreciated the wit. But there were other more substantial examples.
Tell me.
Well, when Jim Garrison started the investigation of the assassination and attacked the Warren Commission findings, I used that on the stage. And a lot of people didn't want to hear that. Anyway, I found a way in through humor to bring up what people didn't bring up.
But in doing the reading, I was so interested to find out that you were almost silenced by the Kennedys. I mean, they didn't appreciate you linking JFK to the mafia and to Frank Sinatra, and you practically lost your career because of it.
Well, it sort of didn't happen that way. It happened on the Jerry Lewis program. I was a regular in the Jerry Lewis show. And there was a joke in there, and everybody took umbrage at the joke. But
what was the joke?
The governor of Nevada said that Sinatra shouldn't be a shareholder in the Calneva Lodge because he had mafia guests, and you don't like the kind of people they mixed with. So I said that would include President Kennedy as one of the objectionable people. So Kennedy got mad. Sinatra got mad. Everybody got mad.
I see.
And Jerry Lewis got scared.
And did you really almost get sort of squashed? I mean, you people were afraid
Not
to hire
directly
you?
Directly as a result of the Kennedy family. I mean, when I brought up the assassination, there were a lot of people running from it, including people who said they admired Kennedy. I think the country for a long time was dead. And it now understands the cost of silence. Last night, Hillary Clinton said, "We shouldn't have our minds on the last war. We should be thinking about the next war." And no comedian took her to task for that. Hmm. Nobody said anything. So it just shows you the trouble a woman can get into when nobody loves her.
Hmm. Well, Mort Saul, thank you so much for joining us today.
Okay, Anthony.
I appreciate it. That's comedian Mort Saul. His current tour is called Mort Saul Saves the World. For more on the tour, visit our website, here-now.org. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. Be sure to join us again tomorrow, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.